Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is Cliff Mogg, founder and owner of Mogg Audio. First of all, let's talk about Kanye West and his album updates. Could this be the production wave of the future? Well, let's back up for a second. Kanye released his latest album called The Life of Pablo on Tidal a few months ago. And while most albums, once they're released, they're finished. Everything is locked. In this case, that's not true. Kanye has been changing the mix. He's been adding parts. He's been changing the mix in general on most of the songs on the album as we go along after the fact. Now, one wonders if this might be the way it's going to be from here on in. Now, just think about this. You place a deadline on yourself, or the record label places the deadline on yourself, to release an album on a certain date. And even though you're not happy with the mix, or you're not happy with the way it sounds, you hit that deadline anyway. And there's a good reason to do that, especially if there's a lot of press and if there is a marketing campaign all set to go on a particular date. You definitely want to be with your marketing campaign, so you want to do that. So you release it on that date, knowing that you can always come back and you can fix things later. Now, there's good and bad in this. The good part is you can keep on fixing it until you're happy. And that's the bad part. You can keep on fixing it until you're happy. One of the downsides I see is the listeners beginning to like a certain mix, and all of a sudden it's gone, and there's a new one up there, which may be different, maybe radically different. I don't know if I'd want to jeopardize that. I don't know if I'd want to keep on supplying a lot of mixes after the fact. Because again, after a listener gets used to a mix of a song, you don't want to change it on them. I'll give you a good example of how this works. There's a lot of hits from the 60s and 70s that the artist, in order to make more money, they basically do a redo. So they'll go into the studio and they'll redo an album completely and then put it out. And they own it. In that case, instead of a record label owning it, they own the recording, so they'll make more money. I know Foreigner has done this, for instance, and there's a lot of bands, especially, that have done this. So when you go looking for the song, you may get the same song on Spotify or wherever, Apple iTunes or Apple Music, whatever the case, even YouTube. And you go and you listen to the song and you go, wait a second, that's a little different, especially if it's a song that you've lived with for a really long time. But you know right away there's something different about this, because you can never quite capture the feeling of a mix over again. Even though you may recall it, it's never exactly 100% the same. It's getting easier now in the days of the DAW. But way back when we're doing it on consoles and now you try to duplicate it, it's definitely going to be different. So that bums me out when that happens. And if I'm listening to something, I can tell immediately. And it's like, oh, I don't know. I really like the original. What worries me is if this is the beginning of a trend where we have the never-ending finished product. Almost like software, where software keeps on getting updated all the time. It would bum me out if mixes were patched all the time, were redone all the time. So let's see if that continues to happen in the future now that Kanye has opened up the door on it. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com. I just launched a couple of new mini coaching programs called Lead and Background Vocal Mixing Tricks and Ultimate Punchy Drum Tricks. You can go to bobbyosinskicourses.com to learn more. There's been a lot of talk about privacy, and this really goes over the last 18 months or so, and it's getting more and more intense, especially with the Apple versus FBI lately. And here's something that's happening that has to do with the audio that's kind of frightening as well. Your phone is listening all the time, and in many cases, it's picking up a lot of information about the songs you're listening to. It's picking up information about the television shows that you're watching. It's picking up information about where you're at. And then it's supplying it to certain apps and companies that are using that as marketing information. There's now a company that's called Silverpush that actually embeds inaudible codes in some TV shows and in some movies and in some audio recordings. And there are a number of apps that will actually listen for that code. The problem is, if you're a user, they never asked you for permission. And usually this happens. If an app is going to take control of your camera or take control of your microphone on your computer or your phone, they almost always ask. But in this case, they haven't. So they're collecting information without you knowing. And the FCC figured this out and has basically slapped them on the hands, saying, you better not do it. And if you do, you have to tell people that you're doing it from now on, give them a chance to opt out. What's insidious about this is the fact that you don't even have to have the app activated in order for it to listen. Now, if you're an Apple owner, you've had this happen for a while, because especially if you have a new phone, a new iPhone, you have the feature that's Hey Siri. And Hey Siri is terrific, especially if you're driving in your car and you want to listen to something, activate something, whatever. You just say, Hey Siri, and then it asks you what you want to do and you tell it. So that's a wonderful feature, but it means that your phone is always listening to you. Freaks out some people. Other people don't care. Where do you fall on this? Would you rather have complete privacy? Are you open to some limited incursions on your privacy? I guess we're going to find out in the future, but this thing with Silverpush is kind of scary, and thankfully, the FCC, which usually is not so prescient, they finally got involved in this and kind of figured it out and hopefully went to bat for the rest of us. My guest today is Cliff Mogg Sr., longtime engineer and founder of Mogg Audio. As the inventor of the NTI EQ3 and the Night Pro Pre-Q3 and EQ3D, Cliff introduced equalizers with the Airband to the world in the early 90s. They've been a secret weapon of hit mixers everywhere since. Mogg Audio prides itself on providing the best product possible, and it really shows, as you'll hear in the following interview. I spoke to Cliff via Skype from his studio in Provo, Utah. Some of the things that you were telling me were just so interesting, and it gave me an insight, and I've used these things as examples, and it was especially your passion for audio, your passion for developing the best product, which was outstanding, and I've used your example numerous times since then.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. It comes pretty easily when it's something that you really love and that you take that time to... it's just exciting when you're working with the sounds and, you know, and making the best happen with what equipment you have. And then you learn more and more and more, you know, as you hear better equipment, better microphones, better singers, better musicians, all of that. It all enters into it. And it's what a great experience it is to be involved in audio.
Take me back to the beginning. How did Mogg Audio begin?
Mogg Audio, how all of the technology came together. Where it started, my first passion was I was writing songs. I'd been performing when I was in high school and was with, you know, an old spinoff from the big bands, you know, a local sax player and great players. So we had a small group, a combo group, and we did a lot of dance jobs when I was in high school that went on even after I was married for a few years. That love of that and being involved in from just the sheer sound of the music and the songs that were being done back in the 60s, the early and late 60s. That's where the passion for the music and the sound part of it came from. And then once I started writing on my own and doing some of that, then it led to a studio that I built and had to do my own studio. Started out with an 80-8 Tascam.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I remember
TX and the TX and the Tascams, and I mean, I went through all of that, you know, all through that era of analog. Then one thing led to the next, and before you know it, I had a Stevens 24-track and a custom built console that we built that a friend of mine had built, and then it just one thing led to another because of the desire for the song. I had clients that started to come in, and then I had clients that became more picky about the vocals and the way things were sounding to be able to compete on a national stage with, you know, in the sounds that they were getting on the big records back in the 80s and, you know, and seven later 70s. So for me, the all of that, that part of it was really key, because I had to be able to compete vocally with those, with what the great engineers and the, you know, all the big studios had. Now, I had to build had all of my stuff that I ended up here on a smaller scale, because I had to pay for it myself. But the desire to get those sounds was as great as, it was really strong for me to do that. So I what I ended up doing is that was the foundation for Mog Audio and for the development of the EQs and preamps and you know, our equipment came from the desire to get great vocal sounds. That's where it first started from, and to get great mixes. And what I did is I got one great vocal chain, which was a C12, a vintage C12 that Stephen Paul modded for me, a 1.5 micron elements in it, back in the 70s or 80s, I guess. Then I had the twin servo Boulder preamp that I got at that time, and that was really popular back then.
Yeah.
And then I had my LA2A that I had. So I had those three things. And what I learned, I just remember how great these vocals were sounding in the 80s, you know, where everybody was going down to half-inch two-track, ATR 100s, 104s. That's what I was going down to. And I had my Stevens 24-track that was just amazing machines. And so I had the capability to get great sound, you know, to great equipment. But the one thing that I was lacking was that open sound in that vocal. And when I got those three elements, the Boulder and the C12 key for that open sound, and then my LA2A, when I had those three, I could never turn back. I was never satisfied with what I would hear out of the console from the preamps and the EQs and the things that were in the console. And then the desire to have that openness that the C12 gave me in that open sound in the vocal, which we called it air, you know, that airy sound in the vocal that was happening. I desired to have that or be able to hear that on other microphones, because I knew it was in there. The microphone element just couldn't deliver, you know, wasn't delivering as clearly as a 1.5 micron element can deliver that real open air sound in it. So with the Boulder, we ended up building our own preamps, and to make a long story short, that's where the Airband was born, because I wanted to have we built the preamps. I had four of my own preamps in along with my other Boulders that I had put into that power supply that allowed me to be able to hear, you know, what I was to be able to test my preamps against the Boulder.
Yeah.
And so we came up with a great preamp. That's where the Airband was born, because we developed it, you know, the Airband in the preamp side of it to open up other microphones that I had, like U87s and even 57, even my ribbon mics. And that's where the Airband was born. And the first Airband was nothing more than just a huge hiss switch. But then we learned what we had to do, and we had several patents that came from that, learning that. So the Airband was actually born in a preamp.
Okay.
Then we took the preamp, and we had the EQ that we were using in the board that we had designed and developed that. And then the Airband, we decided we'd put the Airband on in that EQ, and that was just magic as well. So that's where the EQ4, you know, the Airband and the EQ4 was born. It wasn't the other way around. People would think that it was born in the EQ.
Yeah.
It was actually born in the preamp.
Well, on the EQ4, the selection of frequencies that you can modify, they're unique.
Well, thank you. Yeah, they are. They are unique. And because of that positioning where they're at, there's virtually no phase shift in this EQ. If you take the five bands and you set them to flat, then you're flat, you know, zero in, zero out, you know, +4, +4. Then when you go to boost it, they're totally in phase. So when I boost 650, it raises the volume or the gain straight on because of the frequencies that are there. And that is on purpose. It has to be that way for it to be so musical and to not create phase shift when you push the gain or you pull the gain at a selected frequency.
So the frequencies were
very important.
The frequencies were based upon the phase shift then?
Absolutely. Okay. Because there was not one on the market that we could even come close to that had no phase shift.
Okay.
So now you have these selected frequencies that were selected to make so that it would, what came in goes out the other end. And when you boost a frequency, you don't take, for instance, you don't take 650, and when you boost it up, you don't have it shift in phase. So now it's behind the timing of all the other frequencies to be summed back together, basically. Mm-hmm. No, it's dead on time with where it originally was. It stayed an apple and remained an apple at 650 until, you know, no matter how high you gained it.
Yeah.
That's a big deal because it doesn't destroy everything on each side of it. You know, so phase shift was very, very, very important in my eyes.
Well, let's come back to the airband for a second because, again, the frequencies are unique there, especially like 40K.
Yeah.
You don't see that everywhere.
I know. I remember when I first came out with 40K, and I'll tell you why it was put in. First off, it's hard to have a circuit that will not add hiss and be weird pushing it clear out to 40K. I mean, you know, beyond 40K, maybe 230K.
Yeah.
I mean, it isn't a matter that anything out there that we can't hear, even 40K we can't hear beyond out there. I know that.
Yeah.
But it's important that it can do it. And the reason is if you take and you realize that that's a shelf at 2.5, 5, 10, 15, 20, and 40K. Now that shelf, as the shelf, and I'll show with my hand here, as the shelf moves out, so now I'm at 40K. I'm clear out here with the shelf, but I'm catching the very open end of just a perception of presence that you can hear.
I see. Okay.
And so what you want to do when a guy is using that at 40K, turn it to 110. I mean, get it up there to, you know, a 3 o'clock position or a 1 o'clock position, because all you're picking up is the very tail end, the very end of the... Of what you can, of the presence.
Of the roll-off. Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay, I get it. Well, when would you use that? Give me an example.
I'd use it on mixes all the time. Mm-hmm. And what'll happen is if you have a mix that's going, and you've got it where it's really feeling good, this is just my, you know, one that I've learned, yeah, that I love. If I've got a mix that's going and I've got it in, I kick in my EQ4 at the end of it. And if I take it at 40K, and I've got it and it's sounding great, I can improve that it feels almost more alive than it did before. All of a sudden, there's just more clarity and presence in things. And it's like, wow, what, you know, how did it do that? You know,
yeah.
But if you don't push it hard enough, it won't do that effect.
I see.
So you have to push it far enough to where you just catch the end of that. And all of a sudden, the presence opened up and it feels like, wow, that is not live. That is live. That is real. That is not real.
Yeah.
I'm actually hearing I'm hearing the feeling of what it was like live.
When you selected the frequencies of the airband, you were basing it, if I get this right, you're basing it around what you had heard on with the C12, right? Trying
yes.
to replicate the C12, the sound
right.
of the C12. Mm-hmm. But I would think that would be one frequency. So why did you put the other ones in there?
Well, as you remember, it was born in the preamp.
Yeah.
So if I have a 57 on a snare, and I want to add a little 2.5 or 5K, mm-hmm. boom, pop that in. There it is. I don't have to kick in a whole EQ, and it's part of the preamp circuit.
Hmm. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So you get the vision of that.
Yeah.
Now if I take a ribbon mic, and I don't even know what's in the high end of that ribbon mic.
Yeah.
Because I've never heard it before until I open up the high end of it with the airband at, 15K, 10K, 20K,
yeah,
depending on what is playing on acoustic guitar or on a viola or a cello, mm-hmm. Different instruments, that you'll want to pick up, even a vocal, you can open up that high end that is actually in the ribbon mic that we're not going to hear until we actually reach in there and pull it out.
Mm, okay. I get it.
It's in there. It's in there is my point.
Yeah.
And we're able to just enhance that high end. I know a lot of guys that'll take in Nashville that will use for overheads, they'll use these preamps and ribbon mics with the pre-Q4s and just to open up for the cymbals on just a kit for the overhead.
I could see where that would be very effective because, ribbon mics especially could use that.
Oh yeah. You know how great they sound on drums.
Yeah.
For overheads.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So how about the sub band, which again is unique?
Yeah. Well, the sub band, it's down there quite a ways. If you've recorded things well and you've used the correct high pass filters and different things as you're going down, so you don't have anything weird going down in there. The subs, down in the 10 cycle area.
Wow.
So that's way low. But again, it's another shelf that is going to boost and as it boosts, it's going to lift in the frequencies just above it a bit.
Yeah.
So boy, it adds a lot of just warmth in the bottom end and punch down in the bottom end, the low sub stuff that you can really dial in.
Yeah, I know. It's one of my favorites, actually. And it's interesting because it does feel warm without sounding woofy. And that's the problem you usually get, when you add a lot of that down there. It just sounds like this.
Yep.
So, yeah.
And you know what? That's right.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is, it's because of the angle that it's on. It's not getting the reason it doesn't sound like what you just said is it's not reaching up in there far enough to do that.
Yeah.
It just pulls that nice warmth up in the bottom. It was on purpose and needed to be where it's at, right where it's at.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go back for a second. Night Pro. Huh? What happened with Night Pro there?
When we originally did Night Pro, we worked really hard and we came up with the EQ3, mm-hmm. the pre-Q3, and the EQ3D. So we had three products that we had come out with, and everybody worked so hard on it. Everybody had their heart in it. And we just didn't have the marketplace that could keep the company going. Mm-hmm. We had to just didn't have the sales. When we first started, I know a lot of the engineers, and I know this now because I've talked to them since, but they kind of kept it originally, the EQ3, as their secret weapon kind of thing back in the 90s. And so they would show their close friends, but it was not made a big deal of. Since it was made a big deal of later because it was on so many things that were done back through the 90s and the last 25 years. And I have taken these guys that are telling me now I couldn't believe all of the records that it ended up on. It's just so awesome to be able to hear from these great engineers that I really didn't know that they were using it on those major artists, on all these songs that I loved so much over the years, that they were using it on their mixes. And so it was great to be able to see that, but that's why the company didn't make it though.
I see.
To revert back is because we just nobody totally knew about it, but guys liked it, and we made enough to go for a while, but it just couldn't sustain itself with to operate. Then things changed.
Well, it makes me wonder then if you saw that happening, why would you start into the business again on your own? I know the reason, but I just want to hear it from you.
Okay. All right. Well, my younger son, both of my sons were with me, and my other partner, Travis, was with us as well back in the early in the early days. So they worked for me and worked with us at Night Pro and NTI. And my oldest son actually built most of the EQs, threes and the preamps and all of that that are out there now. Mm-hmm. And Ryan's right there with him. Travis did a lot of the technical stuff on things that we had come in, so that he had a background of it too. Well, so those guys were with me, and the company stopped. But then my younger son came to me 21 years later and saying, "Dad, man, they're talking about the EQ3s all over the internet." And he says, "You know, you need to do that again." And I said, "Ryan, I've been there, done that. I'm not going to do that again."
Yeah,
I said,
yeah.
"There's no way I'm going to go through all that again, because we put our whole heart in it and in the original go around." But he wanted me to do it so bad, and he needed some support in his life too, right at then, that, would be something that he could kind of hang on to and, you know, be something that he could be a part of.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided that, well, let me see what we can do. And he showed me the 500 series stuff. And I got with Travis, and we put Mog Audio together. And hence, you know, we were able to just do it because of all the background that I had on the other. We were able to put it together and make Mog Audio fly with his brother, Ryan and Cliff and Travis. We were able to build the company and put out the products again, but improved even from where we were originally.
When we had dinner at NAMM, I was so impressed when you were telling me about the precision that you take, the care that you take in building your products, especially the story about the pots.
Yeah. On the EQ4M, on a 500 series, you can put the different, every potentiometer when you're putting one in, they, when they're set at the zero position at, you know, to be at flat,
mm-hmm.
they all have a different value. They're going to have a different value because they're just potentiometers, and there's going to be a tolerance in there. On the EQ4s, we don't have to worry about that so much. I'm able to take and do an EQ4, the 500 series, and I can dial those right in and set them so they're within a tenth of a dB of plus and minus to be flat right across. Do that easily, and then I can take and gain them and match those. I can match those pairs because they're individual units. And so I can pair them up, and then I send them out as pairs in sequential order of the serial numbers. And I know what each serial number's value is. So if somebody tells me they have serial number such and such, I can match the value structure of that one so that when they adjust it, it'll be accurate. That's on the 500 series.
Yeah.
On the EQ4M, they're both in the unit. You can't pull one out and put one in. So we had to come up with a way to make it be accurate from, like, at 2.5K is identical to 2.5K as you boost it in the sweep of the frequencies. So mm-hmm. if I boost it 4 dB, it's 4 dB on the other one. They're identical.
So both channels are exactly the same then. Yeah, right. Yeah,
exactly. In every frequency. So one isn't a little different from the other. And the way that we do that is we spend a lot of time going through potentiometers and zeroing them out at the center position. And then we have like 46 bins that all these potentiometers go in. So for the particular frequency, every frequency is selected from this range of bins, and the two that go in that unit come from the same bin for each frequency. So it's a pretty rigorous way to do it, but it makes them match, and it's worth the effort, because when you get through, they're within 3/10 of a dB of each other. If you took all of the gains in the EQ on both sides and took each frequency and boosted it all away, they're within 3/10 of a dB of each other. If they're all boosted, they're the same gain. It's just, it's amazing how accurate it is now.
That's awesome. That's very cool.
We do that on every unit.
Is there a difference between the 500 series and the rack mount?
Yes, absolutely. The 500 series, we have 16 volt plus and minus rails that we have to stick by.
Mm-hmm.
That's just part of the format. With the EQ4M, we're at 18 volts. So we're able to have plus and minus 18 volts, which gives us more headroom.
Yeah.
You know, headroom, you know, it's wonderful to have, you know, that headroom. And so when you come out of your tube bus to the unit, for some reason, it's just, man, it's just got the headroom. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like you can EQ and you're not quickly turning it down, even though the EQ4M has a trim that I can back it down, you know, accurately bring it down if I want more EQ. But I can like EQ it a lot without pushing it into the red.
Mm-hmm.
Then the other thing, every circuit that you build, I don't care whether it's, if it's in the EQ3, original EQ3 NTI, or this new EQ4M, or the 500 series, or the EQ3D, every one has a little bit of character difference in themselves. This particular one, the EQ4M, man, I was talking to Dave Pensato about it the other day, and it's just creamy to me. I don't know how to, I mean, when I finished it with the boys, I said, I love this thing. It's like whenever I tweak it, it just feels great. And it's different in that circuit, just in how things set with, you know, towards one another and how they set with power supplies and everything else that's in it that makes them just a little different from each other. The important thing is that they're consistent from one to another in the same series that they're in. If they're in the 500 series, they're going to be consistent across the board. If they're in the two rack series that we just did, if one is going to be consistent to the next one, you know, down the line.
Yeah.
So a lot of it is just how the circuit lays out.
How about the plug-in? How accurate is that to the hardware?
I think it's really accurate. I think it does a great job. The one thing that we can't duplicate with plug-ins totally is what capacitors we're using, what resistors we're using, and what different op amps we may use in one place or another in the unit.
Mm.
You see what I mean? I may select a different op amp for the sub, for instance. I may, you know, it just, you can't change a ton of that particular character in, you know, that happens just automatically with analog.
Yeah.
In any analog device, the capacitor is going to enter into it. Transformers are going to enter into it. You know, and we can simulate all those things in digital, but they're not exactly identical. But it is the EQ that I go to when I'm, you know, when I want a fast EQ in Pro Tools. It's awesome, and the air band's awesome in it. I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, me too.
And I love it. And I love it in Pro Tools. I love using it.
It's one of my go-to EQs for mixing in Pro Tools for sure. It's on every mix.
And you know what? One of those things that's happening, even though I know we're doing it digitally, it's still that reference of where they're at and the phase shift problem. You know, even though we're in digital, is still in the correct place for that to be what we normally hear.
That's awesome. Wow.
What we want to hear as we boost. That's why I feel like it sounds so good.
The preamp that you build, the pre-Q4, how close is that to the original ones that you built?
Oh, very close. Very close. The only difference in it now is the capacitors that I'm using on the air band. See, I'm using a different set of capacitors that we kind of handpicked all of this stuff when we started this next, you know, the MOG audio stuff. That was the one thing I wanted to work on, me and Travis and the boys. We wanted to make sure we got the capacitors that we liked in those different areas and the character that happens with those.
Mm-hmm.
So we put in the particular capacitors, and I still use some of my old pre-Q3s. I love them. I've got 12 channels of them here that I use in the studio all the time. Would I select to go to them or to the other one? Well, when I'm doing a vocal, I still go to my brand new ones. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Even though I know the other one is going to be great on it, it's going to be wonderful on it, I still do because I know what I've, you know, I just know what I've done in there.
That actually says a lot. It would probably worry me if you said the opposite. You know, I always go back to the old ones. You know, that would mean, but that brings up.
But I'm not afraid to.
Yes,
I would do it. Absolutely, they're wonderful preamps.
But that begs a question then. Sourcing components must be very difficult in the fact that you're very choosy about your needs, basically.
Yes.
And it's not always easy to get what you need and the time period you need and what happens after you run out. And then so the restocking, all those things are very difficult for a small manufacturer.
It is. That's why I have on hand here at our facility, on hand, I think it was like 7,000 of one particular capacitor that's very difficult to get a hold of. And when I call to have the next set of boards done on a pre-Q or an EQ or whatever it is, then the manufacturer that we have that helps us to stuff the boards and to, you know, procure that, they will, you know, go get all of the parts. And if they can't get that part, I have it immediately. So all of those hard to get caps and things like that that are out there, I already have thousands of them, so that then they can get them for me. I'll send them out to them and they'll replace my stock. And that's what we decided to do early on.
Yeah, yeah.
So we never have a problem with those hard to get parts. And there always is hard to get parts.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm curious, do you feel that the products that you have now, done them as best you can, or are you always experimenting to try to go another step? Because sometimes it's like, well, maybe it's just better to build a new product,
yeah.
You know, rather than taking a product that you have and you know, trying to get the next percent out of it or 0.5%. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, the one thing that about myself and the boys and Travis is we like the experimenting part. That is it's a fun thing to do. That's how you come up with something that hadn't been done before. The airband was something that hadn't been done before, like we were doing it. And because of that, we came up with something that was unique to put it in an EQ.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you already had 2.5 there. All of a sudden, you're throwing another EQ on top of it, basically, kind of what it feels like.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? That's how that came about. We're doing that right now. As a matter of fact, we're developing a new product right now that... it'll be a compressor that we'll have, and it will have a lot of stuff inside, but it will be simple to operate. So it's going to have a lot of components inside that deal with the sound, you know, that with capped capacitors and different things that we have to do, but it's going to be a unique. Compressor, and I hope that people will like it. I've been using it currently, the first version of it, and we're in that process of our main version of that now. So
does this kind of harken back to your original LA-2A?
That was the first thing that it does harken back to. You remember, if guys know that an LA-2A, man, it's like the high end just flies through that thing. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And if you take another type of compressor, it will not be as kind to that open high end, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I love what that did and learned what that did. And this I've held on to for this particular thing that we're coming out with for many years, back even before the original, back about when the preamp, original preamps were done, where we came up with the airband and that. It goes back that far that I'd used, but now we've developed it even further from what we've learned with the EQs and the preamps that we've worked on and developed. Now in the EQ2, man, all of that has led to this unit that we're currently working on now. And, so yeah, we're going to keep developing stuff and trying to come up with something that has something that's unique and that fixes maybe a problem that maybe you as an engineer have dealt with at times.
Yeah.
And we found ways around to correct things. This is a pretty slick way to do it in correcting some things that we maybe in tonal things that we want to do with that the compressor.
What impresses me about you and your team? Well, first of all, your attention to detail on what you're doing because of your love for the product is very cool.
Thanks.
But I love the fact that you're an engineer who's working with the best gear and searching for the best sound. And everything came from that, because there's a lot of manufacturers where that doesn't happen, where you have somebody that, you know, doesn't have those big ears because they're never exposed to that type of thing. And you're coming from a different spot, which is why I have a feeling everything sounds as good as it does.
Well, thank you. And there are only four of us.
Yeah.
If somebody picks up our EQ or a preamp or this new compressor or the EQ2, I build it. My two sons, Travis. I mean, we are the guys putting it together. We're the guys taking it down to send it out to you. We don't have a big operation. We don't plan on having a big operation. We want it to be hands-on. We want it to be when I finish it or my sons finish it, I want to be able to say, I would use that unit. I would be happy to have that unit in my studio right now. Not a question. Send it to me. I'll plug it in. That's what I want to. That's what I do. That's what we want to do as a group. So we don't have a big group to pull from to do it, but we have had a lot of experience in the studio to know where we need to maybe improve or improve what the sound is, get a better sound. That's where we come from.
Okay, so you started with what many would consider the ultimate signal path, the ultimate chain.
Yeah, back then it was.
Still is. But if you were to get the ultimate chain today, what would you do?
It depends on what I was, going to get. It would be the PreQ4. I would absolutely be the first item on that list for me. And there's a reason for it. The EQ, the preamp, is built to duplicate what I hear out at the piano, duplicate what I hear out in the room, in the big room, not to make it different than what I hear out there, even though I may want to color, a preamp that will color, something to do that particular thing, but to duplicate what I'm hearing there, be accurate that way. That's why this is not a colored preamp. And what I learned years ago, as I added a lot of those in particular deal, I ended up subtracting out some of the things that the other preamps were adding into it when I had to do the mix. So for instance, if I took one preamp and I wouldn't do this, but if I did and cut 100 background vocals on one part, okay?
Yeah.
By the time I get to 100, and if I'm adding that color on all of those parts, I'm going to be pulling something out. You know it. I know it.
Yeah. Well, it's the same if you're using the same microphone over and over. The same thing happens. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but if you take the preamp, the PreQ4, and you do that, and I've had engineers tell me how many they've stacked them, it's the one that they use, because when they get to the end and they bring it back into the mix, they're not pulling out what a different preamp would be adding with that many. They don't have to EQ it when they get to the end of it.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's what I look for in a preamp. That's why, to me, that's a very important part of it. I learned that years ago, how important that was to have it be transparent and have it not add color that I'm going to have to subtract out if I have a whole bunch of it in there.
Yeah.
Okay, so that to me is a very important thing, and the first thing in a chain, whether you're dealing with a ribbon mic, I don't care what mic you're dealing with, a C12, a 251, whatever it is you're dealing with, I want to hear what that C12 does on that vocal, and that microphone will help to bring out the openness in it, depending on which mic you pick. And the preamp is going to deliver what's there.
Yeah.
And so that was the first thing for me. The second thing in the chain to me that is very important is to have great EQ on mixing. and in a vocal. Sometimes the microphone will be just a little lacking in the mid-lows. And boy, with EQ4, for instance, that allows me just to bring that in. And I literally will commit that EQ to the track because I want the engineer that, if I'm not going to be mixing it, that he has that the tone that I was hearing, you know, that the artist went down with.
Yeah.
That we wanted down. So there's that with the EQ when I'm tracking vocals, for instance. Then the other thing is really important to me is a compressor and where that fits in the mix too. And I have all of my old tube, I have Gates compressors, my Bowers, and I've got two or three Gates, a twin dual limiter compressor, Gates, you know, all of the, some really great old tube compressors that I've used on the tube bus for years. And this new compressor we're doing, I think will be a real addition to use on the tube bus for mixing as well.
Sounds very cool.
So that's kind of a chain I would be looking at anyway.
last question for you. What's the best piece of business advice that you've either learned along the way or someone imparted to you?
Wow, what's the best business advice? You just can't get discouraged. I mean, I remember when I was early on, George Peterson, he was with Mix Magazine.
Yeah.
And I can remember how frustrating it was because we knew he had a good product. And I remember one time at AES with George that I sat down with George and he had done a review on this on our EQ3 and he loved that EQ3 and he told me, don't give up. He says, I love this. And he says, I'm not going to give up on you either. And so I learned from George to hang in there and to not get discouraged and to still go for those things that sound amazing to you. And I'm talking about to you as an individual.
Yeah.
And trust yourself. Trust yourself. It's easy to second guess yourself. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That, you know, and so you have to, boy, that's working. And then the other thing that I learned, and I can't remember who told me, if it was Dave Reitzis or somebody, you know, get the piece of equipment, or if they told me, or Dave Pensado, one of them, basically, if you got that piece of equipment, you got to use it long enough to make sure that you really like it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
If it became something that I would use, then I couldn't let it go out of the studio. I knew I had a winner. Boy, once it worked, they know what it felt like and when it was right. And so I learned to trust myself more in that regard. And I learned that if I built a new unit, for instance, this new compressor we're doing,
mm-hmm.
I've got four here that will never go out of my hands. I mean, you know, and now I'm not saying that meaning anything more than, if they weren't that good, I would be using my other compressors.
Yeah.
I would be using them. But they are, there's not a time that they don't improve what I'm finishing up. And so I won't even let them out of the studio.
That says a lot.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
no, I get
so
it.
I learned that by those guys. Make sure it's something that you can't depart from.
Yeah, yeah.
Before you put it out.
Good advice. Cliff, thanks so much for being with me today. This has been great. It's I knew this was going to be fun, and it certainly was. It's great to speak with you again.
Well, thanks for having me, Bobby. And it was great to meet you, and it was great to be with Russ Hughes and the guys.
Yeah.
Thanks so much. You were so kind.
To find out more about Maag Audio, go to maagaudio.com. That's M-A-A-G Audio, all one word, maagaudio.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbiointercircle.com. questions@bobbiointercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com, and he's responsible for putting the show together. Many, many thanks, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or you can go to bobbyoinnercircle.com or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.